actually is based on these two papers with John Donahue and Muhammad Al-Husseini. So this is an outline of my talk. I will start with a brief review of renormalization group in perturbatively renormalized field theory. After that, I will discuss effect field theories. And gravity, of course, is a very good example of an effective field theory. I will also review very briefly the standard results in renormalization group. After that, I will try to answer the question, can we really define running couplings in the presence of gravity, like Yukawa coupling or the charge of QED? And finally, I will try also to shed light on the running of the gravitational coupling constant G Newton itself. So let us start with a very brief review of renormalization group in perturbatively renormalized field theories. And then when we do perturbation, we always need an expansion parameter, and this has to be dimensionless expansion parameter. So for example, if we take the lambda phi to the fourth theory, our expansion parameter is lambda. And we say that this theory actually is perturbatively renormalized in the sense that you need only a finite number of counter terms in order to absorb all the infinities to all loop orders. So if you are interested in doing the renormalization group for this theory, all you have to do is just to calculate the tree-level diagram and the one-loop correction. Of course, you can go to higher loops if you are interested in high precision. So when you do that, you'll find that your amplitude is given by the tree level, lambda, plus the one-loop correction. Here I'm using the Mandelstam variables, st and du. Basically, these are different of momentum square, p1 minus p2 square, for example, this is s. And once we have the amplitude, now we have to also supplement a renormalization condition. And you can choose your renormalization condition to be either on-shell or off-shell. So here I am using it to be off-shell. So I am taking my s equal to t equal to u equal to minus 4 over 3 m squared. So here I am actually going to the Euclidean space. So in this case, if you choose your renormalization condition to be this one here, your coupling constant L lambda as a function of m will take the following form. Now, you just proceed as usual to find your beta function. You just take the derivative of lambda with respect to m, and you find this expression. And this expression is universal, and this is a very important point that I have to stress here. Why we say it is universal? Because if you try to change your renormalization condition, so if you choose your st and du not to be minus 4 over 3 times m squared, you take it whatever you want, okay? So all this is going to change is just some new number here inside the log. However, when you take your derivative with respect to m, the beta function will be completely insensitive to this renormalization condition. And hence, this beta function is universal.
But this only holds at one loop, right? I mean, if you go to higher loop orders, it will not be universal.
In practice, it should also be universal. No, I mean, this actually, if you are in perturbatively normalized theory, this has actually to be the case even if for higher loop orders. We can talk about this later, but all right. So once you do that, okay, now all you have to do is just define now, instead of having a bare lambda, all you have to do is just to change instead of lambda to have lambda as a function of your energy that you are interested in. So when you do that, you are left with the residuals like log s, log minus t, log minus u, and possibly plus I pi factor. All right. So we can also do this calculations on shell instead of off shell. So in this case, you take s plus t plus u equal to 0. Here it is also important to notice that if you do it on shell, then you have to treat log minus s like log s plus I pi, and just you get rid of the I pi. So the I pi is not important at all for the purpose of the renormalization. again, you get exactly the same beta function. So the beta function here is universal. And it is robust against the symmetry crossing problem. And this is also an important point. Here, it might not be actually very obvious because we are using lambda phi to the fourth theory. So you sum over the ST and U channels. However, if you were doing it for the Yukawa, and if you would do it for the S channels, and then you cross the symmetry to TT channel, your beta function also is going to be robust and universal in this sense. Let me also notice that you have some floating non-analytic pieces like log minus q squared, like in here, for example, in the last line. And these give rise to long-range quantum effects. All right. And these are actually observable. So now let us now move to the effective field theories. And in effective field theories, actually, you don't have a dimensionless expansion parameter. However, you instead you expand in powers of E over lambda, where lambda is just a UV cutoff. And in order to believe your theory, your energy scale has to be less than your cutoff. In this sense, actually, let me also mention that effective field theories are not perturbatively renormalized in the sense that you need an infinite number of counter terms in order to absorb the infinities. Of course, at each loop order, you need only finite number of counter terms. But however, as you go higher and higher in loop orders, you will need more and more counter terms. And in this sense, it is a bit less predictive than perturbatively renormalized. Normalized field theories. A very good example of effective field theories is Einstein gravity. So our action is just the Hilbert-Einstein action. Lambda is just a cosmological constant, and kappa squared is 32 pi g Newton. And here our expansion parameter is E over m Planck. So our UV cutoff is E Planck. And we mentioned that the effective field theory actually can be good enough for energies less than m Planck. This tells us actually perturbative quantum, effective field theory of gravity is a good theory of gravity to scales almost of the order of m Planck. All right, so again, gravity is not perturbatively renormalized, so we need loop correction. The loop corrections will actually demand an infinite number of counter terms. So if you start with Einstein action, you'll generate terms like R squared, R mu nu, etc. Let me, however, point out that for the case of pure gravity, if you don't couple gravity to matter, we find that the gravity actually is finite to one loop order. And this is because R mu nu equal to zero. This is the equation of motion. And we always can actually substitute this equation of motion back into your Lagrangian. So if you have terms like that, these terms will drop out, and you will have finite gravity.
Does this also hold in the presence of a cosmological constant?
Not really. No, I don't think it holds. However, of course, this breaks down once you go to the two-loop order. This completely breaks down and is not true. All right, so now let us see what will happen if instead of having pure gravity, we just have scalar plus gravity. So if, for example, you calculate this one loop, you will find that this calculation will yield terms of the order of the form R squared, R mu nu, R mu nu. And this is a very important point here. Because this tells us, actually, if you try to calculate the quantum corrections to lower order operators, these quantum corrections have to be absorbed only in higher order operators. And this is a general statement for effective field theories. Whenever you have quantum process for a lower order operator, this will be absorbed only in higher order operators. Actually, also in the case of gravity, we'll find that there are some non-local remnant terms that they are like log minus q square or square root of minus q square. The log minus q square is a quantum piece. However, it turns out that the square root of minus q square actually is a classical piece. And this is contrary to what people usually learn in the case of in the textbook, because in the textbook we always say that actually you have to expand in H bar, or loop corrections are expansion in H bar, and this is actually not true in the case of gravity. So let me just, let me skip this because I'm running out of time. So now let us try to, so this is just an overview of the standard gravity. So let us now try to answer the question, does the inclusion of gravity actually improves the UV behavior of the coupling constants of non-asymptotically free theories like QED or Yukawa? And this question actually is raised by asymptotic safety people, as well as Robinson and Wilczek in 2006 in the case of perturbatively renormalized, in case of perturbative gravity. And since Robinson and Wilczek published their work, there has been a tremendous number of works that appear trying to say that, okay, you have running, other works say you don't have running. And some people say that you even run in the wrong direction. So even if you start with asymptotically non-free theory, you still have asymptotically non-asymptotically free theory at the end. So now I will try to answer the question: does the running really make sense in the case of gravity, at least in the perturbative sense? So in order to answer this question, let us consider the following process. Let us consider Yukawa. So you have G phi psi bar psi coupled to gravity. So all you have to do is just to calculate this one loop correction. And in this case, you find that your amplitude is given by this form here. However, we mentioned that in order to define a beta function, you have to supplement a renormalization condition. So we have to actually to use this renormalization condition. So you can take, for example, P1 square equal to P2 square equal to minus Xi1m square, where Xi1 is here is just a number. And also you have P1 dot P2 equal to minus Xi2m square, Xi2 also is a number. And it turns out also that this process will depend on the nature of the process. Is it a time-like or a space-like process? Here it means that you actually have also to introduce another parameter, eta, which is equal to 1 for the time-like and minus 1 for the space-like. Now, if you just look carefully at this structure here, you find some problem. Unlike the case of perturbatively renormalized field theories, where all these parameters were inside the log, now these parameters actually are outside the log. They are multiplying the log. And this is a sign of that there is something wrong happening here if you try to absorb the one-loop correction as a running in the coupling constant of Yukawa G. Of course, this one-loop correction will generate operators O1, O2, O3. And the standard way of dealing with this correction is just to absorb them into coefficients of these operators, O1, O2, O3, rendering the coupling constant G not running under the effect of gravity. So the standard procedure is that G will not run if you take into account the quantum corrections to do the gravity. But however, let us now try to force a definition for the running of the coupling constant, and let us see what we will get. So you can actually cast the amplitude in the following form, and you can impose conditions on the coupling constants G1, G2, G3, and G. So G1, G2, G3 are just the coefficients of the operators O1, O2, O3. If you do that and you solve for your beta equation, your beta function, you find the following. First, the first contribution here is just the normal contribution from Yukawa corrections, from the perturbative renormalized Yukawa. The other term here actually is due to gravity. And let us see what is happening. Actually, it depends on eta times xi. Eta can be plus or minus 1 depending on the nature of the process. It is time-like or space-like. And also xi2 is a renormalization condition. So this tells you actually that the beta function that you tried to, that you got is not universal. It will depend on the renormalization condition and on the process. Is it time-like or space-like? And this is a disaster. This tells you that this is not a sensible definition of a running coupling constant. Of course, you can try different ways. You can do this exercise on shell or off shell using whatever conditions you like, and always you get this problem. So this actually concludes that there is no natural way of defining running coupling constant like Yukawa coupling or QED. Now, let me just move very quickly for the case of gravity. So if this, if you cannot define a running coupling constant like G in the Yukawa, can you really define a running coupling for the Newton's constant itself? And in order to answer this question, we will consider different processes and see if we can find a universal answer to our question. So the first thing actually is to calculate the vacuum polarization. Why? Because this is a universal diagram that enters into any calculations of quantum gravity. And if you take this diagram, if you take the amplitude and of this diagram and use it to define a running coupling constant G of Q square, you'll find actually that your Newton's constant G will increase for space-like processes with energy. Will decrease with energy for time-like processes, and it will also increase in energy if you go to the Euclidean setup. So there is a symmetry crossing problem if you just take the graviton loop into consideration. So let us try to do something more physical, which is the scattering of gravitons in pure gravity. And this was done by Dunbar and Norridge. So this is the tree, and this is the one loop. And if you do your calculations on shell, because this is a physical process, you find that actually your coupling constant is given by this form here. And if you look carefully, you find that G actually increases with increasing the energy, which is against what people who do asymptotic safety of gravity find. And this is actually for the maximum helicity amplitude A++ to A++. If you cross the symmetry, if you go to A++ minus to plus minus, you find also G has the same behavior, that it increases with increasing A, but with different coefficients. So you lose the universality. Finally, okay, let me just show you that, okay, can we define it using a scattering of massless scalars? You do this correction, this calculation, and you find that if you do on-shell calculations, you find your G of E decreases with increasing E. This is opposite to the case of pure gravity. You don't have universality. And now try AB to go to AP. Try this process, and let us try to use the amplitude as a definition of the running coupling constant, and you find that G increases with increasing E. All right. However, if you cross this symmetry, if you cross the symmetry, this is the T channel. If you cross it to S channel, you find that actually G increases with increasing E, opposite to what we found here. So there is always a problem of the of defining your beta function. Basically, you don't have an universal running for the case of gravity. So let us just come to my conclusion. Actually, we found that there is no universal and useful definition of running constants in gravity, at least in the perturbative regime. And actually, this raises questions about non-perturbative attempts in gravity, like in asymptotic safety program. Thank you.
So, as you said earlier on in your transparencies, I would have thought you have to distinguish between, you have to decide which operators you're trying to renormalize. You seem to be confusing the operators with, you pile all the operators that's being produced into one operator.
Yes.
By mixing up the kinematics of the momentum by saying, well, you know, I'm going
to
set them
all. All right. If you try to do it the normal way,
yeah,
you end up having not running under the case of gravity. So G, okay, the correct way is that G does not run actually under the effect of gravity. This is the correct interpretation.
In the way that you're doing, I think that is the correct interpretation. The second point to make is this has got nothing to do with the asymptotic safety program and the way that things run in the asymptotic safety.
Yeah, why?
Because, you know, the the reason that G, you reach a fixed point in the asymptotic safety
parameters
is you're not expanding around the Gaussian fixed point. You have to posit that there's some long-term.
Well, of course, I understand. I understand that, but this raises questions. I'm not telling that this means that the asymptotic safety program is wrong or doing something wrong. I didn't claim that. I said that it actually raises questions about this program and what does it mean actually to have a beta function in asymptotic safety program.
So again, the beta function in asymptotic safety is not something that's running with, it's not calculating some amplitude and fixing some momentum scale and looking for that, running for that momentum scale. The running is running with respect to an effective cutoff you put into the theory.
Yes.
And you're asking how the action evolves as you change the effective cutoff.
Yes.
I think the questions are just totally different.
No, but I can also ask the following question in an asymptotic safety program. What happens if I have two gravitons and I scatter them? Yeah. All right. So can I define a beta function in this case? I mean, from the point of view of asymptotic safety program or not?
Yeah, possibly. But I mean, that's about some non-perturbative fixed point, so it's not asking the same question that you're asking.
The problem is that, when you do field theory, whatever process you consider or whatever procedure you do, you always end up having the same beta function, right? I mean, let me give you. Make this point clear, okay? Let us do, for example, QED, all right? QED, and let us, if you like QCD in the UV or QED in the IR. So if you do your calculations on the lattice or using a asymptotic safety program exact renormalization group or perturbative calculations, you always get the same result.
It's well known that at higher loop orders, if you have dimensionless couplings, the beta functions will be universal at one loop, and I'm not sure about the two loop, but they will definitely be non-universal at three.
What do you mean by non-universal? It will be scheme dependent. Yeah. I agree with you. Yeah, this will be scheme dependent, but problems like that.
If you have dimension full couplings, then the non-universality, the scheme dependence, is just shifted.
Well, but this is not only about the scheme dependence only. It is worse than that. It goes to the level that your beta function actually is ill-defined, that it can actually shift signs or so flip signs under the exchange of the channels of interaction that you're interested in.
Different physical processes. Yeah. The couplings.
Yes.
The couplings in front of different operators, when you define them in terms of scattering processes, then there's really no reason to expect that scattering operators, operators belonging to scattering processes, which are not the same but just similar, that these couplings will actually run in the same way.
The beta function should be universal. Whatever process you are considering, no. If you told me no, then I cannot understand what you mean by your beta function in this case.
If the discussion for the coffee break later on.
I think I'm chairing you now, but.
We have to agree to disagree at this point.
Yeah. Since we have time in the session, we will definitely discuss later. Okay, so let's thank our speaker again. So now the next speaker is going to tell us how couplings run in gravity.
All right, we'll try. Non-perturbatively, then. Was that working all right? Probably, not that I need it.
Great, so our next speaker is Tobias Hens talking about dilatant quantum gravity.
Right, so I'm going to try to tell you why you should care about dilatant quantum gravity, even though it's the last 2 hours of the conference, and at least I'm tired, and I suppose that goes for many of us. Still give me 15 minutes to sort of interest you in that approach to gravity and to that interpretation of the running of the gravitational couplings within the functional normalization group. So this is work that is done in Heidelberg in collaboration with Jan-Martin Pawlowski, Andreas Rodegast, who is also sitting here, and Christoph Wetterich, and you can find more details on the calculations on the archive. So, give you a brief outline. First of all, let me sort of set the stage of what we're going to do. Non-renormalizability of gravity is perturbatively well understood. And then briefly kind of introduce the asymptotic safety scenario again. And then rather fast cut to open questions, and the question about, especially the question about the actual interpretation of the fixed point that we all hold dear. And then there's going to be some FRG analysis, which is rather technical, and I'll end with a summary and outlook. So first of all, let me just flash that flow diagram again. That's something you know from Frank's talk from the beginning of the week. And the important thing here is that point up here, which is, I think that's running out of battery anyway. So the important thing is the point up here, which is known to be, or at least in that approximation, known to be a fixed point in the renormalization group scale. So the couplings do not run anymore once you approach this point in the ultraviolet, that is for high momentum scales. And well, that would actually mean that gravity is, as opposed to what you find if you try to renormalize down here, close to the Gaussian fixed points, where both the cosmological constant and the Newton constant, both dimensionless, vanish, that gravity would actually be renormalizable there. Then there's still some, you know, work that has been, quite some work that has actually been done since then. One thing that I want to point out is that flow diagram that you also already saw during the week in Andrea's talk, which is work done in Heidelberg last year. And the authors also find the fixed point up here at A. They find infrared fixed points that you'd usually have at D and B down here. And the really new feature here is improvement in the infrared, which is a stable fixed point down at C here, which is at lambda equals 1/2. And that's actually quite interesting, because with that comes not only asymptotic safety in the ultraviolet, but also a possible extension towards the infrared, which you'd obviously want to have if you want to compare what happens at low and high energies. Coming from there, there's still a lot of open questions. First of all, there's obviously technicalities about the method we're using, the functional randomization group. We always have to add a regulator, and we'd obviously have to check whether or not our cells depend on the choice of regulator. Also, most of the calculations are carried out in a certain background, and you'd also want to have those the main results independent of that background, and also of the truncation you choose. You have to sort of define the theory space that you're working in. Heard a lot about that in various talks. I'm not going to talk about that too much today. Then also, once you have established that gravity is actually asymptotically safe as it is, you'd still need to couple it to the other fundamental theories that we have, namely the standard model. And then again, the infrared limit is not so well established yet, so you'd want to eventually end up with a theory that sort of tells you how gravity evolves from the infrared to the ultraviolet, or the other way around, and if general relativity actually is the right low energy case. And then the what I dubbed the hierarchy problem, that the scales of the standard model and the scale, like the Planck mass, which you could take as a scale of quantum gravity, are so vastly different, you'd still sort of have to find an explanation for the ratio here on a fundamental level. So, and the last two questions are what we'll be dealing with if you do Dillon quantum gravity. And in addition to that, let me just show that diagram again. And this point up here is the important thing, the fixed point. But then what actually defines a fixed point? So in our calculations, what we do, we search for solutions to that equation. So where the dimensionless couplings of some variety may just be lambda and g, or you know, whatever kind of enlarged truncation you're looking at, do not run anymore. But that means that the very definition of a fixed point is that scale becomes irrelevant there. And what we are trying to do is get a new notion of scale. So why not just encode the scale in a real scalar field, which we call chi, which then has the dimension of a scale. And what you'd then have is that on the fixed point, you have a scale symmetry, a dilatation symmetry, which is intact and exact. And a scale invariance with that relating to what's up here. And away from the fixed point, you'd enter some kind of broken phase of that dilatation symmetry. And with that, you generate a non-zero Planck mass. And what that actually means, there are two important implications if you would be able to establish such a theory. First of all, you'd had realistic gravity on a pure fixed point trajectory. So since you generate a non-zero Planck mass on a fixed point, just via breaking of a symmetry, there's no need to depart from the fixed point anymore, which makes it rather pleasant to deal with. And the next thing is, since you're introducing a scalar field, which potentially is physical, you'd have an interpretation for the renormalization group scale K, which is also something that you'd need to actually do physics with the asymptotic safety scenario. So how do we actually realize that on a more technical level? Well, as usual, you do the most easiest thing you can imagine. So you take Einstein Hilbert and promote it to a scalar and tensor theory, allowing for a potential of the scalar field for just generic functional. Then you'd have a coupling to gravity via another generic functional F, and you'd obviously need a scalar, a kinetic term for the scalar field. And that type of action was actually first investigated by Narayan Pakachi in 2010. So we are sort of drawing on the same set of flow equations which we derived. But what we are doing is especially paying attention to the infrared limit and the trajectory from the UVAR, ultraviolet to the infrared, and also trying to improve the UV analysis a bit. So then, other than that, that action, that effective action, where you'd have the parameter K in there, the next crucial ingredient is dilatation symmetry. I already talked about that a little bit, but let's just make that a little more clear in a mathematical sense. So what I mean when I say dilatation is a conformal transformation of the metric with a constant factor of omega. Thus, that's the global part of the conformal group, if you sort of want it like that. And then that's dilatations would actually just be a global resetting of the physical scale. And well, if you'd have a theory that is dilatation symmetric, that in turn means that there is no physical scale a priori. So the only scale that'll enter your theory is the one that you'd get by having a non-zero expectation value of the scalar field. And then you'd have a Goldstone boson, the usual process, and that's what people actually call a dilaton. And you can derive that an action is invariant under dilatations if and only if all couplings have scaling dimension zero. And in our case, for the action that I just showed you in four dimensions, that only allows for a term chi to the fourth in the potential with some prefactor, which is constant, and a chi squared term for the coupling to gravity. And right, so that's the thing that we'll pay special attention to. So adding to the box that I already talked about, the characterization of a fixed point via dilatation symmetry, what I'm going to try to establish via a FRG analysis today is a scale invariant infrared limit for Einstein-Hilbert quantum gravity. Then we'll hint towards the generation of a non-zero Planck mass by the breaking of a dilatation symmetry. And then you'd have quintessence cosmology scenarios arising from that. I won't talk too much about that due to time constraints, I suppose. All right, so the type of fixed point that one would expect, and I'll tell you without actually doing flow equations why you'd expect that in a moment, is, well, if you just define y to be chi squared over k squared, so that's sort of a dimensionless version of the scalar field, and factor out the dilatation symmetric parts of both v and f, so that's factor of y squared, chi to the fourth in v, and chi to the fourth, yeah, chi squared y or y in f, then what you'd expect for large y is to end up with a constant in f and a vanishing potential, which in the Jordan frame would lead to this rather simple type of fixed point action. And if you translate that in the Einstein into the Einstein script frame, where your usual Wiley rescalings, you'd actually end up with a Planck mass right here. So why would one expect that fixed point? Well, if you suppose there is an f naught, which is just the limit of this little f for y going to infinity, so that's just the dilatation symmetric prefactor for y going to infinity, then you'd have gravitational interactions that scale precisely like 1 over f naught and 1 over chi squared, which is just, that's the Newton constant, so to say. But then that's precisely what could induce a gravity flow. And you'd have to take the dimensionless combination, which then is 1 over f naught, 1 over y. But that vanishes for y to infinity. Furthermore, if you have a vanishing potential, you have a free scalar theory then for y to infinity. And we now, from the study of just pure scalar theories under the renormalization group, that the term that you can produce is at most, in our language, proportional to v minus 2, that's a constant, v minus 2, that's a constant in uppercase V. Thus, you don't have any gravitational interactions. You just have a constant in the potential. So what you'd expect asymptotically is this form. And well, we'll use the normalization group to actually establish that in a little more precise manner, and also look at what happens away from y going to infinity. So just a few technicalities. We do know of R truncations and a wave function renormalization, curved background spacetimes due to that heat kernel methods, Littmann cutoffs that scale, make the modified propagator scale like the original propagator with a shape function, did on a gauge fixing in four dimensions. So what we derive is a set of fixed point equations at fixed y, and I'm not going to give you those functions theta. They are rationals with the propagators in the denominator and depend on whatever is shown here. So the fixed point equations then actually are going to be partial differential equations of second order. And well, the first and most immediate thing you do is look at the asymptotics for y going to zero affinity. And you usually do that via Taylor expansion. That's sort of the easiest thing you can imagine. And for y going to infinity, you'd find finite limits for the flow generators. That's finite flow equations, but that also means that there's nothing that would go to infinity that can actually run. But that also means you have, as I claimed before, a constant that the functional f goes to. And that holds if you also set v equal to zero in infinity. And your flow equations are going to be close, so you can actually solve them order by order in the Taylor approximation. Conversely, in the ultraviolet, the set of flow equations will not be closed. So what we do, you could either cut somewhere and just solve whatever is left over, or you treat two parameters as free, sort of. I mean, that's just, they're not really free. If you could actually solve the full system, they would be set, but for our purpose, we could treat them as free and optimize them in a way. And once you have the asymptotics, you're going to be interested in global solutions. And I'll show you a little bit about what we did there. First and most immediate global solution is just purely Einstein-Hilbert plus a free scalar field. That's a perfectly acceptable global solution. You can derive numerical values for that, and that's just fine. Nothing happens there, so it's not overly too interesting, but it's possible. And the second thing is that you do, you take your Taylor expansions around y equals infinity, and you try to continue those. What is shown in the plot are different orders of the approximation. You can see that they actually hold true down to a really small scale of y. That's 10 to the minus 5 down there, starting from infinity. And even if you just take one term, 1 over y for f, you're still really good. So what you see here is, I mean, you kind of expect Taylor approximations to break down at some point. They can continue smoothly to y equals 0, obviously, because you got all those 1 over y terms. So this actually seems to be the radius of convergence of the series itself. And it looks like the perturbation theory that you put up sort of here breaks down. So what we do is a resummation. What you want to do is your Taylor solution obviously work rather well, so you want to stick with them as long as you can. And just want to smoothen them for y going to 0 to sort of give them the chance to not diverge and connect to what you know for small y. And the first thing is a Padea resummation. You just expand both numerator and denominator in powers of 1 over y, and you still get the dependency on that parameter, xi. So what I've shown here for v and f is the Padea approximation coming from here and going to a finite value here. So that's good. Same story here. But then if you observe this v Taylor, that obviously comes from a different finite value, and it's actually not so much is happening there. That's not a constant. You should stress that, but it's not varying too much over the scale. So next thing that we've done here, actually, to come closer to the global solution is we did an exponential improvement. So to that Taylor series, which obviously does not connect to what you know from Padea, from y come to from infinity, we added some exponential terms with the coupling. Y is plays the role of a coupling here. And with that, you can actually smoothen that out. You can define an error and all of that. So we see that this solution is sort of reasonable. It's obviously not exact, and it's not ideal. But we strongly believe that there is a solution in that general setup that sort of looks like that. And I got another minute to summarize, I suppose. So what I showed you was a dilatation symmetric infrared limit due to this behavior of the functions, which is completely self-consistent, and then obviously those functions vary, so the dilatation symmetry is breaking somehow. We don't quite understand the exact mechanism yet, but something is happening there, and that points towards the possibility of realistic gravity on a pure fixed point trajectory, which is quite exciting, I think. You can also go into quintessence cosmology, so I won't do that, and due to the fact that V actually goes to zero, you have a vanishing cosmological constant on the fixed point, obviously, in the infrared, and that also holds for small deviations from the fixed point. So you'd still get cosmology with vanishing cosmological constant in the infrared. What you'd obviously want to do as a further research, there might be different classes of solutions that would solve our problems there. You obviously do want to enlarge your truncation as usual. What we recently have done is redone the calculation with the wave function randomization flat backgrounds. There are no results that we can present yet, but we work on that. And then since you have a gravity coupled to a scalar theory, you might as well add matter and explore the Higgs sector and the running of the Higgs couplings under the functional randomization group. That's it. Thank you. Then you'd have a dilaton, yeah.
But we don't see one in the real world, do we?
I don't know. On which momentum scale, I suppose, is the question. I mean,
it's going to be a massless scalar field. So
you'd want to see that in a cosmological setup somehow. Okay. Well, I suppose you should get a massless dilaton, yeah, in that theory. That's correct. I'm not quite sure if there's further constraints arising from enlarged truncations that will sort of make it experimentally possible again. I guess we're not that far in the analysis.
You might well expect the dilatation symmetry to be broken by quantum corrections. That might actually save you.
That I guess we're just not that far, yeah, but that's true. I mean, that's something to sort of fix at that stage, yeah.
So the second question was a technical question, really. I mean, so you keep only order R in the truncations. So does gravity, does that have a chance to feed back into the scalar field, into the dilatation field, dilaton rather?
As in, does the running of the gravitational coupling feed back into
the
potential?
I guess the fluctuations from the graviton give you contributions to the scalar field today.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, of course, it's fully coupled. Yeah. Was that the couple of questions?
That was two questions. Thank you.
More questions?
Yes. Let me ask about the regulator that you use in your computation. Does it preserve the dilatation symmetry? Or is this a source of breaking?
Well, that's a good question, I suppose. Well, for the since for the infrared and projected at p equals zero, I suppose you're good. So in the infrared, you should should be fine. But then you get the breaking. Your question is that just due to the regulator or due to physics? Well, what we've done is we quickly go to the flow equation and come back here. So you get regulator-induced terms back here that come with the derivatives of F. And we've done the analysis without those, and we see the same behavior. So I guess that's the answer I can give you. So there should be something physical about it.
Further questions? Let's thank our speaker again.
Thanks. I'm going to be able to use this soon.
Also, plug it in.
just.
And our final speaker for the session is Kevin Fowles about fixed points of FFR gravity.
Okay, so thank you all for coming to my talk, and thanks to Astrid for and the rest of the organizers for organizing this nice conference. I'm talking about fixed points in FFR gravity. So, don't think that's working. Wait.
You can't go to the next slide using your key.
No. Wait.
Okay, something is not running
after all. Okay. So I guess we're all here because we're looking for a theory of quantum gravity. So if we want a theory, we want this theory, first of all, to make physical sense and therefore not have any physical, unphysical divergences. Secondly, we want it to be predictive. So we want to be able to make predictions, and this means that we need to have a finite number of parameters that we need to fix by experiments. And thirdly, we want to be able to recover classical general relativity, which we observe on a large distance scales. So there's two lengths associated with gravity in quantum mechanics. So there's the Schwarzschild radius coming from gravity, and then say the quantum wavelength of some mass. And once these two length scales become of the same order, we expect quantum effects to become important. So this is at the Planck scale. as we know, gravity is non-renormalizable in the perturbative power counting definition of this, and this is due to G Newton having a negative mass dimension. But Gomez and Weinberg have pointed out that gravity, like many other theories, is renormalizable in the modern sense, in that if we include an infinite number of terms in the gravitational action, then we can actually absorb the infinities which come from loop corrections into these infinite number of couplings. So at low energies, we know that gravity can be described just by the low order curvature term, so by our cosmological term and by the Newton term. But as we go to higher energies, then we expect this expansion to break down, and then all the other couplings come into play, and the theory is no longer predictive. Asymptotic safety is a way of restoring predictivity to the theory through a fixed point of the beta functions, so where the dimensionless couplings become independent of the scale, of the renormalization group scale. And so on one hand, this finiteness of the couplings should satisfy that there's no unphysical divergences. And then the predictivity is restored if we have the fixed point, so where all the beta functions vanish, and then we can look at perturbations away from this fixed point, and then we want the number of directions which come away as we go to low energies. We want these number of directions to be finite. So in this equation, we have the beta function linearized around the fixed point, and then it has this general solution, so lambda are the dimensionless couplings, lambda star is the fixed point coupling. So then this is the stability matrix, and the V's are the eigenvectors of the stability matrix, and the thetas are the eigenvalues. So then to have this critical surface, finite dimensional means that we need a finite number of relevant operators, which is where this eigenvalue is less than one, the real part. And this ensures that the theory is predictive, since although we might be in infinite space, we just sit on this finite dimensional space where all our renormalizable trajectories sit on this finite space. So these are only the dimensionality of this surface is then the number of free parameters. So if we're doing, uh, if if we're looking at the theory of weak coupling around the Gaussian fixed point, then we know that the quantum corrections can be neglected, and that the scaling, the beta functions, just get given by the canonical mass dimension of the coupling. And this means that we can immediately tell in gravity that there are only two relevant operators and a finite number of marginal operators. So in gravity, there's the cosmological constant term, so gamma is the metric here, and the Einstein-Hilbert term, proportional to R. So these are then going to be the only two operators in the IR. So energy is much smaller than the Planck energy, where the dimensionless G Newton is going to zero. But away, so in asymptotic safety, we look for a fixed point in the non-perturbative regime, because we know that where G vanishes is the classical theory, is the IR theory. So away from this classical theory, these quantum corrections are going to become important. And that means that we need to calculate what these corrections are to see if, at a non-perturbative fixed point, the infinite number of an infinite number of irrelevant couplings turn into relevant ones and spoil this predictivity that we hope if there's only a finite number of relevant directions. So to do this, obviously, we need to carry out calculations in the non-perturbative regime of the theory. So what we proposed in this recent paper with Daniel Littim, Christoph Romerda, and Kostas Nikolakopoulos is this bootstrap approach, where we basically include only a finite number of operators in a truncation up to a certain mass dimension d, and then do a calculation within this approximation. And you can use many different methods to do this, such as renormalization group or lattice, such as CDT, or maybe the holographic renormalization group. And then you can do this calculation and see measure your critical exponents to see how many relevant operators you have. And then after you've done this, in the third step, you increase this maximum dimension D and repeat this process. And the hope is that since in the perturbative regime, we know there's this relationship between the canonical mass dimension of the operators and the relevancy, we hope that this only makes some sort of finite changes, so that there's still, in the non-perturbative regime, some relationship between these the relevancy and the eigenvalues, the canonical mass dimension. So then by studying this step by step, we can see whether this is a good assumption and these are good approximations or not. So we're using the f of r approximation as a test for this. So this is a more technical slide, so using the Rettig equation and these cut off to get the beta functions. So I'll just skip over this. So the main point is that we use this effective action, which goes from the bare action in as we take k to infinity, where we expect to see a UV fixed point. And when we take k to zero, the renormalization group scale to zero, we should recover the renormalized couplings and the full effective action. So we introduce dimensionless quantities. So here is a dimensionless function of so R is the Ricci curvature, rho is then the dimensionless Ricci curvature, and then we have a flow equation of this form. So this was originally derived by Mikhailo and Saurasik, and similar equations by Cadello, Pikashi, and Romerda. So these equations are, for small r, effectively the same. So as I say, this side is where the canonical mass dimension is on the left-hand side is encoded, and then I encodes the fluctuations. So here we're going to make a polynomial approximation to finite order in an expansion in rho. So then we have done these up to order n equals 35, so included 35 couplings, looking for fixed point solutions. And here I plot some of the values of the fixed points, so starting at lambda 0, lambda 1, lambda 2, etc. And as you can see, increasing in the order we get a convergence very good of the first two couplings. Lambda 2 can be notably seen to be less well converging. This is because it's a zero mode of the left-hand side of the fixed point equation. But as we increase the order, even the higher order couplings begin to converge. And previously, this was done up to order n equals 11. So you can see at 11, it wasn't at that stage clear whether these couplings would converge. But pushing this to order 35, we really see that this fixed point solution of these polynomials converges very well. So we also see good convergence in these values of the critical exponents. And when we look at to see how many relevant directions there are, after we've included three couplings, we see that there are always, as we increase the increase the order of the approximation, that there remains just three relevant directions. So obviously, this is great news for the asymptotic safety conjecture, because we're not really, as we increase the number of operators in our action, we're not then just increasing the number of free parameters that we need to fix an experiment. This seems to be saying finite, at least in this approximation. So then we've calculated all the critical exponents for all these approximations. So I plot all the fixed point data here. So the different symbols, which are noted at the top, correspond to the orders in the approximation. And then what we've done is we've simply, since these there's no sort of canonical way of ordering these numbers, the critical exponents, since each one you can't actually relate to a single polynomial, a monomial in the polynomial. So we've ordered them here in order of increasing size of the real part. And then we've plotted this against where you would expect the Gaussian line to be. So this dotted line in the back, which you maybe can't see, which just goes is a linear fit here with n, where a is 2 and b is 4. This is what you expect in the Gaussian fixed point, so where you have these two relevant operators. and as you can see, our value for these fixed points lies very close to these Gaussian values, which is really a very good indication that, in fact, these corrections, quantum corrections to these eigenvalues are bounded, and they're not becoming infinitely large, which could destroy this asymptotic safety, and are actually very near to the Gaussian values. So we did a linear fit here, and then these numbers came out from our data, sort of averaging over our data as 2.17 and 4.06, with an error of 5% and 10%. So obviously, if we extrapolate this sort of behavior to higher orders, we get a very good scenario, which really looks like even if you add, say, R to the 200 to this, that you're not really going to upset asymptotic safety and get a new relevant direction. So I think this is a really an encouraging result. And so those results were just concerned with the UV behavior, but obviously to have this third criteria of restoring the classical limit, we need to have an RG trajectory that comes from this UV fixed point and connects us into the infrared. So I have some preliminary results here when I've included four couplings up to the R cubed coupling here. And the idea there is to see if we can, as I say, find trajectories that connect from the UV fixed point to a Gaussian fixed point, which is where classical general relativity lives. So at the fixed point where all of these couplings, G, the dimensionless Newton's coupling, lambda, the dimensionless cosmological constant, and then there's C2 and C3 for the higher order terms, these all vanish as we go to the semi-classical regime, and this product of G times lambda can be made to be arbitrarily small. So we need to tune our trajectories to try and make this small, because obviously the observed value of this is 10 to the minus 120. So at the this infrared fixed point, the cosmological constant is a repulsive direction, which means we essentially need to, that's why we need to tune this number because the dimensionless cosmological constant, which is to diverge as we take k towards zero. So at the UV fixed point, I think this is the first time that there has been flows from a UV fixed point where the there's an irrelevant direction at the fixed point. So this means that the space of the critical UV, the renormalizable trajectories, is less than the space of the total couplings. So here I just have, since I have four couplings, I've given two plots. So on this one I've got G lambda and C2, and up here is the UV fixed point, and these are a family of trajectories which all go into this classical regime. So these have all been tuned to have a very small value of G times lambda, which, as I say, can be, you just need to tune this to be smaller and smaller. And on the second plot, I include this C3 coupling as well. And here I plot the combination G times lambda. So you can see again, these go from the UV fixed point into this, into the origin, whereas where the Gaussian fixed point is. So this divergence along this lambda axis is the relevant direction, which corresponds to a positive cosmological constant, where this lambda, dimensionless lambda, diverges as we go away from the Gaussian fixed point here. So this is obviously so far just in the R-cubed truncation, but I think this is very good that we've managed to get these trajectories that hit this fixed point, and it's not just a single trajectory, but you have this real family of trajectories once you go into these higher order approximations because of the dimension of the critical surface. So yeah, these are my conclusions. So we've sort of used this F of R as sort of a toy model approximation for asymptotic safety, and this idea of that there is still this link between the relevancy of operators and their canonical mass dimension. And then we found this UV fixed point in these polynomial approximations with three relevant directions. And this seems in agreement with Benedetti's recent paper, where he found if there does exist a global solution to an F of R type approximation, then this would then imply that there are a finite number of relevant directions. So obviously our empirical evidence from our polynomials that there are indeed just three relevant directions is in very good agreement with this. So, and in including up to R cubed, the classical limit has been found, that where I can find trajectories that link from the UV fixed point into the IR. So the important question is now whether this will carry over to the full theory, where we introduce other tensor structures and fluctuations of the field, and also matter, to see whether these good results we've found here continue into the full theory. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions? Yes?
A very general question. So do you actually have to, so you told that your critical surface is a three-dimensional. So do you have also to stick to the surface from the UV?
Yeah, so
to the IR?
So what I'm doing is I'm tuning myself very precisely onto the critical surface at the UV fixed point to give myself the initial conditions.
Yes.
And then I shoot off this from here.
I see. So when you mentioned the three relevant directions, so these are the Newton's constant, the cosmological constant, and one third one?
This isn't entirely clear. What is true is if you include up to R squared in a truncation, then you get three relevant directions.
Yes, but
if you actually look at the eigenvectors, these aren't pointing just in the direction of a single monomial. So you can't actually say that R is relevant and R cubed is irrelevant. It's not as simple as that. It's these relevant directions are themselves non.
You can go to some basis where you can actually see exactly what R direction.
Well, you would like to be able to do that, but at the moment we're only working in these polynomial approximations. Well, I mean, you're able to see what this is in the vicinity of the fixed point. But
further questions?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Frank. Yeah. I have a question to your integrated flow diagram.
Yeah.
Can can you say something about the sign of the cosmological constant along the flow?
The sign?
Can you find RG trajectories where lambda is strictly positive?
Yeah, on these ones, it's always positive. Yeah. Where it's going to be positive. So you have sort of a separatrix. So all these are sort of a two-dimensional separatrix, if you like. So you have to tune g times lambda to be very small. And then you're basically playing with the UV initial condition. And then you can see how this relates to sort of moving g times lambda to be slightly positive or slightly negative, and then tune it ever closer to being towards zero.
That's fine. But if you have this crossover part of the curve, is there a part of the crossover where lambda?
No, as I say, I think on these lambdas, lambda is always going to be positive along these. The spiral, right?
The spiral, yeah. And the when you go off along the positive cosmological constant direction, you have to die at some point because
So you do indeed die in the far infrared still in these. So I haven't plotted there when lambda gets towards 1/2.
Right.
Then you still have these problems where they believe there may be a infrared fixed point. But in these truncations, I can't continue the flow along positive lambda. Along, if I go for a negative cosmological constant in the IR, then you can continue these towards lambda goes to infinity.
Positive. Well, again, it's my understanding at least, is that that's a cutoff problem that's in the original flow equation.
Could be, yeah.
I mean, the nice thing about going up to 35, I guess, is that you get a large amount of statistics, so you can identify some asymptotic behavior. That's more or less what you were doing on the fixed point and on the fixed points values and on the...
My question
is just that, have you seen, by chance, any at higher numbers, so higher ends, any kind of, can I say, alienation of the critical, the eigenvectors to the actual directions r to the power n, or do they keep being mixed?
They keep being mixed, and it really isn't clear to me from looking at the eigenvectors.
No evidence of.
No.
I mean, if you did the whole thing exactly in the sense that you solved the differential equation, rather, there'd be no reason to expect things to lie along polynomials.
That's what I'd say. It doesn't have any indication that it goes along, single powers.
If you see that the exponents grow linearly with the power of r.
Oh, you're saying that maybe you might have seen that. I guess you might find if you have solved them exactly that they were close to being polynomial even though they weren't.
That's it.
That might
that case you would get a compensation of the power r and the power k that is always the same at the end in the value of its form. But I mean it's just a hope. If it's not the case, it's not the case.
Yeah. As far as I can see.
Okay, good. Let's thank Kevin again.
Okay, thanks.